It is with excitement that I get to share with you that the Leukemia Foundation has developed a new resource. This resource is called the Online Support Service, where it provides a wealth of services to assist a person living with blood cancer throughout their patient journey. So whether you're a patient who has just been diagnosed, in treatment, or in survivorship, this service provides access to targeted learning modules, a suite of amazing services, and online programs. And you also have the ability to chat with an experienced blood cancer support coordinator at just one click. It gives people a personalized and intuitive way to learn about important topics, including what to expect beyond treatment. This service is simple to use and is filled with content curated by the Leukemia Foundation for people with any type of blood cancer. It notably features a digital energy coach to help patients manage fatigue. So jump onto our website and look up our new and exciting product called the Online Blood Cancer Support Service.
You get to a point in life where you think you're in control of everything, and all of a sudden it gets taken out from underneath you.
I guess I kind of felt ripped off.
It's just living in the moment and just being adaptable to situations.
Give people voices to talk about, you know what, that phase is often the hardest, and be prepared for it because it's not what you think it will be.
Talking Blood Cancer, a podcast for those facing blood cancer by the Leukemia Foundation.
Find the best way forward using their own purpose that they have in their life and using their passions.
I've lost fear and doubt. Like, I no longer doubt myself in situations, and nothing scares me.
That gives you another goal to work towards and a reason to live.
Hi, I'm Kate Arkadiv, and I am the host of Talking Blood Cancer. This podcast shares the stories of the people we have connected with who have faced a blood cancer, so that you, our listeners, can gain insight, find purpose, and take inspiration. Before we get into today's episode, the Leukemia Foundation acknowledges the traditional owners of the land on which we share these stories. We recognise their continuing connection to land, sea, and community. As the first storytellers of this country, we pay our respects to their elders, past and present. This story may contain content that some listeners may find difficult and challenging. We encourage anyone listening to take care of their own mental health and well-being. The purpose of this podcast is to share real-life stories of people living with a blood cancer, and any discussion of medical treatments is not an endorsement. We encourage you to seek advice from your treatment team if you have any questions regarding your diagnosis, side effects, or treatment. If you would like to talk to someone, or even if you would like more information on our services or today's episode, please feel free to contact 1-800-620-420, and someone will be able to connect you with your local blood cancer support coordinator. So, let's get into today's episode. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. You will hear the story of Tali Bakalan, who in 2020 was diagnosed with lymphoma. At the time of her diagnosis, she was experiencing yet another COVID lockdown within Melbourne, juggling homeschooling her two children, running a successful baking business, all while experiencing what she thought was pneumonia. The shock and the story that followed after receiving a call from her doctor while standing at her children's school is one to be heard. She describes how her children and her husband were her North Star and helped her never give up hope, even though she experienced several failed treatments. But Tali finally found the light because of CAR T therapy. Hi there, and welcome to the Leukemia Foundation's podcast, Talking Blood Cancer. Today I have on with me Tali. So welcome, Tali.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it is our pleasure. So Tali, every episode we usually start off asking people if they could introduce themselves. Let us know who is in their family, where they're living in Australia,
what they were diagnosed with and what was happening around the time of diagnosis.
Okay, so my name's Tali Batkalan. I'm 48 and I live in Melbourne. I have a husband, Leonard, and two kids, age 14 and 12. At the time of diagnosis, we were in the middle of lockdown number, I don't know what, like 1,000 it felt like.
Yeah.
I was homeschooling the two kids, trying to still run my own baking business from home. We were just carrying on as normal. And then one day we decided to go for a walk along the beach. And then a few days later, I noticed little red welts on my stomach and my back. So I just assumed they were maybe sandfly bites from sitting on the sand. Didn't really think anything of it. And then they wouldn't go away. So eventually I went to the doctor and she said, let's just do some bloods and here's a cream for your welts. So probably about a week later, my bloods came back and she said they were A+. I'm like, oh, that's great.
You want to be an A+?
Yep. And the welts finally went away, but then I developed really itchy skin to the point where I was scratching so much it basically looked like a werewolf had scratched me.
Wow.
And they were really itchy, especially after the shower. So went back to the doctor. I got a stronger cream and then probably a week or so later, it disappeared. So I'm like, okay, great. My bloods are good. All that's gone. Just kept homeschooling and doing what you do. And then I started to...
Sorry, was it hard to get into a doctor like in the time of the pandemic?
It was, yes. Yeah. Especially during COVID, unless it was like dire, they wouldn't really want to see you. They try to do telehealth and I'm like, well, telehealth isn't going to really help considering I've got a rash. So then probably a week or so later, I developed a really persistent cough to the point where I couldn't even finish a sentence. And I remember going up the stairs and being really out of breath. But I just thought, haven't done it. Well, besides walking around the neighborhood during lockdown, hadn't really done a lot of exercise. And finally, the kids were allowed to go back to school. And I remember my mum saying to me, I really think you should go check out that cough. Doesn't sound right. I'm like, no, it's fine. I'm too busy. And then one morning I was taking the kids to school and I remember looking into the mirror and thinking, oh, your skin looks really grey. You look unwell. So I made an appointment with the doctor, but because one of my symptoms was a cough, they said, okay, can you wait outside? I'm like, yes. So anyway, got in to see the doctor. The room was upstairs. So I remember getting up the stairs and starting to cough because I was so out of breath. And the doctor said to me, you can't be in here. You better get out. No. You have to have a COVID test. I said, well, I haven't actually been anywhere. So I know I don't have COVID. I said, I just need you to listen to my chest. That's all. So she basically did that from an arm's distance, not sure how she would have heard anything, and then said, well, you better get out. So went home, got prescribed Ventolin. She said it was probably just seasonal asthma.
You ever had asthma in your life?
Yes. Growing up as a kid, I did, but I hadn't. I grew out of my asthma probably when I was about 8. So I thought, okay, maybe possible, but maybe not. Yeah. Anyway, so I had my Ventolin and then my cough just was getting worse. And so probably about a month later, I said to her, look, I really think I need to do a chest x-ray. It's just not going away. I've had my COVID test. It was negative. So you can see me. And she said, no. I said, well, I don't really need to come into the clinic. Just listen to my chest in the car park. I'm cool with that. So eventually got sent for a chest x-ray. The chest x-ray came back that I had pneumonia. So started antibiotics that night for the pneumonia. And then the next day I was told to come and see the doctor. So the next morning called the clinic to make an appointment and was told that my treating GP had gone on annual leave. So they offered me to see somebody else and it was at school pickup time. I said, no, it's fine. I'm on antibiotics. I'll be right. I think that was on a Thursday. And on the Saturday, I got a call from the doctor saying, you need to go and call somebody and just make sure that, you know, your chest is okay. So I said, it's 4 o'clock on a Saturday. Who's going to see me? I'm fine. And she's, no, you're not. I'm like, yes, I am. So anyway, I had a home treating doctor who said my chest was clear. I've just got pneumonia. Continue with the antibiotics. So then on the Monday, a different doctor from the clinic called me and said, come in. We'll just make sure that you're on the right antibiotics. We'll just give you a checkup. I said, okay. So went in and she said, just to make sure everything's fine, we'll send you for a CT scan. Okay, bit bizarre, but okay.
Yeah.
So I went, it was a Thursday, 3 p.m. And at 5:05, I remember so clearly, the doctor calls and says, you'll have to go to emergency. You're going to need a specialist being this close to Christmas. I said, what is it? She said, I don't know. I'm like, okay. So go to emergency. My parents take me. Leonard stays with the kids. I just went in thinking I had pneumonia and a little bit of fluid. So they took bloods, and then about an hour later, they come back in and said, do you know why you're here? Your doctor's explained. I said, yes, I have pneumonia. And he said, no, you've actually got lymphoma. Yeah, I just felt like my whole world just collapsed. I remember my mum just dropping her head into her hands. Yeah, the look on my face.
Because had that been a word that you had heard before, lymphoma?
Only once, when Delta Goodrum was diagnosed. That's all I remember. And I actually said to the doctor, oh, that's what Delta Goodrum had. He said, yes. And he said, okay, somebody's going to call you tomorrow. You'll need a PET scan. You'll need a biopsy.
And did you say this was Saturday?
It was a Thursday night.
Thursday, yeah.
And it was the day, it was the night before the last day of the kids' school. So went home. I remember waking them up and saying everything was okay, just so they'd get back to sleep. We sat at the dinner table and couldn't believe it. The next morning we told them, I was walking them into school and my phone rings and they said, hi, it's such and such. Have you had breakfast? I said, no, I've just been diagnosed with cancer. I'm not really hungry.
Fair enough response, and I can understand.
Yeah, and so he said, okay, that's great. You're having a PET scan today at 1 o'clock. I remember just walking into the principal's office and bursting into tears. Yeah. Had to organize for the kids to get picked up. They didn't know about it. Anyway, so went, had my PET scan. Yeah.
How were the kids? It's your worst nightmare having to tell your kids that mummy's unwell.
So I guess from the minute I knew, we were honest with them the whole way. We never lied. We told them how it is. They both like to know. They both like routine. So I think by us being honest with them helped them. I told them that I was going to be okay, even though I had no idea if I would. And then that afternoon I got told that it was in like my mediastinal area, and then I had to go in for a biopsy. And when I get really nervous, my heart rate is really, really high, but I actually feel fine. But the doctors panic. So when I was going in for my biopsy, they were telling me everything that could go wrong. And because it's in this position and close to your heart and your lungs, and so my heart rate was just kept going up, up, up. Yeah. And it got to like 160.
Oh, my gosh.
But I was completely fine. Like I didn't feel lightheaded. Yeah. I was just obviously very anxious. And so they decided that, the nurses decided they're not going to do it. And they did a MET call. I'm like, oh, my God, please don't do that. It's just going to make it worse.
I'm just anxious. I'm just, yeah, this is your body's response.
Start doing it, please. Just as soon as you start, my heart rate will drop. They're like, no, we're not doing it. I'm like, okay. So, of course, 20 people come in. Excuse me, do you know where you are? What's your name? Blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yes, I know what's happening. Just start the procedure. Anyway, they didn't. I got transferred to another hospital. And then that's where they did the biopsy, and then they drained 1.5 liters of fluid as well.
Oh, my God.
So I feel like if the cancer wasn't diagnosed, I probably would have died from the fluid, and they put it into a soft drink bottle. Oh, this is nice, having a soft drink bottle of my fluid sitting on my bedside table.
Could you feel relief instantly, I'm sure you were feeling many things at that point in time.
No, not really, but it was funny. A few weeks prior to that, I was lying down in bed and I thought to myself, I can hear like a gurgling sound. Well, that was the fluid. Yeah, looking back, I was really unwell, but had no idea.
So were you by yourself, like thinking back to COVID? And obviously I'm based in Brizzy, so we had a very different experience of COVID than you did in Melbourne. So were you going through all these procedures and hospital transfers and whatnot by yourself? Were you allowed a support person?
So you were allowed one person. So while I was waiting, after they met, called me and I was waiting to be transferred, my whole family was allowed in. But then when we got to the other side of the hospital, I was completely by myself, sitting in the ambulance by myself, waiting in the bay by myself, going through the biopsy and the draining of the fluid for 4 days, literally by yourself. And, you know, you're on a monitor because they're stressed about my heart rate, which stressed me even more. So my heart rate was never going down. Then they finally worked out that it wasn't due to, well, it was kind of a little bit of both. It was due to the size of the tumor that my heart rate was also increased, but also my anxiety. So I came home, I think it was Christmas Eve from memory. And then the following Wednesday, so in between Christmas and New Year, I actually found out what stage it was and what chemo I was going to have. And then they wanted to start straight away. And it was literally just before New Year's Eve.
Wow. And what stage was it? Did they tell you?
Yeah. So it was stage 4 primary large B-cell lymphoma. And I was going to have 6 rounds of intense chemo where I'd go in on a Monday and the chemo would run 24/7 up until the Friday night. And then I was going home on the Saturday. And this would happen once every 3 weeks.
Yeah.
But when we heard that, we couldn't believe it because we'd only known of people that go in as an outpatient or a day, day session, and then they come home, then they go back in. We were like, are you sure I have to stay in? And they said, yes. So that was also a massive strain because we weren't expecting that at all. And it was so overwhelming. And so, yeah, once every 3 weeks we had to prepare for me not to be there. And because it was also lockdowns, probably 3 out of the 6 times I'd go in by myself and we weren't allowed to have visitors. So that was extra hard as well.
You say, how do you prepare? But I don't know if you can prepare, but I guess, how did you manage those times?
I don't know. You just do. I mean, they knew, my oncologist knew that I didn't want to be away from home. So they'd try to speed up the chemo. So I'd finish on a Friday, like around dinner time. And then I could be home for Friday night. So even though it was only a few hours, it meant like...
You were tucking your babies in.
Yeah. And that extra night. And, you know, when I'd get home, I'd feel awful. And then for that whole week, the next whole week, I'd feel terrible. You know, my bones would ache and I felt sick. And then the second week, I felt great. Well, as great as you can on chemo, but I felt... And then just as you feel really good and, you know, you're back into your routine and everyone's used to having you home, I'd have to go, well.
And how was that on your husband and the kids?
So at the time, he was still able to work during the lockdowns. So my mum, luckily for us, she helped us a lot, my parents. Mm-hmm. But it was hard and not being able to see them, and it was just the worst time. I think it was harder for them than it was for me. And so with these 6 rounds of chemo, after every 2 rounds, you have a scan to see how it's going. So after the first 2 rounds, it was going really well. About 90% of the tumor had disappeared. So we were like, yep, this is fabulous. We're going to be finished by May. You know, our son's birthday is in May. So we're like, we're going to have a big celebration. It'll be all over. And then after round 3 and 4, it wasn't great news. The tumor had grown and it was lighting up more in the PET scan. So they said, it's okay. You know, it's not too much, but it's still significant enough. Continue with the 2 rounds and hopefully. Yeah.
And in that moment, I mean, that's a big wobble and that's a big blow to receive. And were any point were you at that point when you heard that news, were you kind of reconsidering what you were wanting to do, or were you always like, no, we're just going to keep heading and keep trusting the doctors and their advice?
Yes. And so many people kept saying to me, get a second opinion. I'm like, what for? We've already started. I'm sure it's going to be the same. I don't even know how I'd get a second opinion. I didn't know where to go, who to turn to. So I'm like, let's just continue. So we did. And then, I mean, I guess there's always the thought that it's not going to work, but you push that aside and you straight away when you're diagnosed, you just believe, yep, I'm going to do these, what they tell me, the rounds of chemo, and then it's all going to be finished. Like, I never thought that it wouldn't work. So then when I heard after the sixth round that it hasn't worked and it had grown, well, how's that possible? I was feeling so unwell on the chemo. Surely it was going to have to do something. I was completely bald by that stage.
And how was that for you being a woman?
Everyone was like, it's just hair, it will grow back. But yes, it is just hair, but it's more than hair. It's something that you can't control. And it just makes you feel like everyone was looking at you then because you had no eyebrows, you had no eyelashes. And I always said, I don't mind if I lose my hair, but when I lose my eyebrows or my eyelashes, that's when I'm going to look sick. And I did.
And do you think that's what it is too? Like, you know, we see all those images in the media and in booklets and whatnot, and that is that image of that bald head, no eyebrows and no eyelashes. And you can almost escape it for a while if you've kept your hair or, you know, you can wear a wig and you've got your eyebrows and stuff. But when that mask is completely taken away, does it almost feel like you're on show and you can't hide?
So when I was sick but I had my hair, like when I had just started, unless you told somebody that you had cancer, nobody would know. But as soon as you lost your hair or especially the eyebrows, it was like the looks that people gave you were of pity. And you just want to feel as normal as you can. And you don't want to have to go out and think, oh, what's everyone going to think?
Mm.
And towards the end, I actually walked around with no headscarf or covering. I'm like, oh, well, they're bad luck if they look. I don't care. But then I realized one day I was walking and I was freezing and I couldn't work out why. It's because I had no hair and my hair was always really thick. So I would never be cold because I had so much hair. After the first chemo, I ended up back in hospital on the second week because I had a fever. And one of the doctors came in and just casually said, oh, you're going to lose your hair from today. Okay, I don't believe that, but okay. And then I remember after he walked out, I fixed up my ponytail and I had a huge clump of hair come out. And I just remember looking at it, looked like a little bird's nest on the bed and bursting into tears. And the nurse came in and said, what's the matter? I'm like, I'm starting to lose my hair. She said, it's okay. And then we were discussing eyebrow wigs.
Eyebrow wig?
Yeah. So it's real hair in the shape of an eyebrow, which has like a sticky stuff on the back and you stick it on. I'm like,
no, I've.
Oh, wow.
In the years that I've worked in hematology, I think it's close to 16. I've never heard of that. I need to Google that.
So I bought a pair of eyebrow wigs, but I never was brave enough to use them because I thought, I don't know how. Yeah. I'm going to end up with one up here, one down there. So anyway, my mum showed me how to use an eyebrow pencil.
Yeah.
And by the end, I had the best looking eyebrows. I'm like, oh, wow, I actually know how to draw the eyebrows.
Were you worried at any point about how your kids would feel?
So when I first lost my hair, it was quite long. So then I cut it to sort of the shoulders because it was quite thin and that was fine. And then I kept saying, I think I'm going to shave it off because everywhere you look, there was just hair. And I thought it might be easier just to shave it off. So they're like, yeah, shave it, mum, shave it. And I couldn't. So every day that I'd pick them up from school, they'd kind of look at me and ask, did you shave it? I'm like, no, I haven't, not yet. And then one day I went to the hairdresser, cried, and she shaved it. And then I came home and I said, I did. And they said, let us look. And I was scared to take off my hat. Because I didn't know how they would react.
Yeah.
And they just went, oh, looks nice. Just casually looks nice.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay. And then it was quite soft.
Yeah.
So they kept touching it.
Yeah.
And then when I lost my hair, I kept saying, my husband was happy because, you know, he finally had more hair than I did. I'm like, well, it's not permanent. So don't get too excited.
Yeah.
And then, we just kind of got used to it. being bold.
And then, so, you know, as you said, you alluded to the fact that, you know, those six rounds, that, am I correct in saying it did fail? Is that what they were saying come by the?
Yes. So it failed. And then they said, okay, you're going to have two rounds of a different chemo in the hope to having a stem cell. So that was also like a massive shock to the system. I had no idea what it was. Then we found out that I may have to be in hospital for up to a month. And again,
is this for your cells to be returned or a donor cell?
My own cells. So we had to explain to the kids that, you know, in that month, they may not be able to come and see me because obviously my neutrophils and everything would be so low. Yeah. There was risk of infection. So we were preparing for that. So I had my two rounds of chemo, which made me feel like even worse than the six. So I'm like, yep, this is definitely working.
Did you do anything to prepare? Like, people talk about exercise or nutrition or things like that. Was that on your radar?
So when I had my first chemo, one of the nurses said, if you do these three things every day, you'll be fine. And it was drink lots of water, go for a walk every day and take laxatives. I'm like, really? I don't need to take laxatives. She goes, yes, you will. I'm like, okay. So now I believe her. So I did. I made sure I would try to drink about 1.5 to 2 liters of water a day. And I forced myself to, even if it was just a walk around the block, I'd go every day.
Yeah.
And that did make me feel better. So for the stem cell, I would try to eat. I like nutritious food. I'd continue my exercise. And then, so I had the two rounds of chemo and then your stem cells get collected. So it took a whole week for that to happen because my body wasn't making enough cells. So I had to have the injection every day, which was awful because it gives you such a bad bone pain.
Yeah.
And finally, I think it was on day three, they said, okay, we're ready to start taking your cells. So they did that for 3 days and I ended up with 3.5 million stem cells. So they're like, yep, that's fine. You'll have a good transplant. And then I had a PET scan and they said, unfortunately, you can't do it because you're not in remission. So, yeah, just telling the family that, again, that didn't work and this treatment's not happening was like a roller coaster. You know, everyone's so excited and then you get let down. So my oncologist said, it's okay. We're going to do CAR T cell therapy.
And in that point, were you nervous? You know, I know you had said that you kind of never thought this wasn't going to work, or were you like, okay, am I running out of options?
Yes.
What's this life?
It was at this stage where I remember one night I said to Leonard, do you think I'm going to die? And he said, no, but I'm just afraid that you're going to be sick for a very long time. So
that's so hard to hear. And I think that, did it take you a lot to say that? Because I know where I sit, I have a lot of conversations with people where a patient is thinking that, also a carer is asking themselves, is my life going to be without my person?
Yeah. So it was hard, but then it was reassuring for him to say no, because he doesn't really sugarcoat things. So if he thought I was going to die, he'd say yes. So anyway, was devastated, cried in the oncologist's office and they're like, that's fine, you can spend the whole weekend crying, but come Monday, you turn up and you do what you've got to do. So the whole weekend I literally did cry, but I had never heard of CAR T cell therapy. So they explained what it was. It sounded unbelievable.
In what sense did it sound unbelievable to you?
So the fact that basically they would take my own T cells and modify them to learn to attack the cancer. And then once it attacks the cancer, the idea behind it is that the cells keep looking for cancer. So if it was to ever come back, these cells would then kind of munch away like a Pac-Man and eat the cancer. So I'm like, oh, that's a bonus.
And it almost sounds movie-like. You go, that just sounds too good to be almost true, right?
Yeah. Yes. So then we watched a video about it and I'm like, right, this is definitely, this is it. This is going to work. So there was a lot of stuff that I had to do before. Because my tumor was so aggressive and growing so quickly, I had to have bridging radiation in the meantime because I was the first person in Australia to have CAR-T that was listed on the PBS. So while that was being approved, I had to have radiation to try and minimize the growth.
Can I ask, did you know if people had to go overseas, didn't they, to either receive this or get special consideration for the cells to be sent overseas?
Yes. So a lot of the time it's from America. So we were prepared, you know, if we have to sell our house and go, we were going to do it. But luckily I was approved and the drug was approved. So had, I think it was 2.5 weeks of radiation. And in that time, you had to do a lung function test and a fitness test, had to see a nutritionist and make sure that you're the healthiest you can be. So once all that was done, you get your cells collected again, but this time it was T cells. So it was 4 to 5 hours on the machine. It was quite easy.
Different from the time before, was it?
Yes.
Like, was it a different, yeah?
Yes. So your body kind of didn't have to create as many cells as the previous time. So that was good.
You didn't have the bone pain or anything like that?
No. You basically had to lie still. If you needed to go to the bathroom, you had to take the entire huge machine with you, which was an adventure. But we did it. And then they're like, okay, the courier's here to collect your cells. So they packaged them up into, it looked like a cardboard box, but a little fancier than that. And it had a tracker padlock on it. And inside was a foam container. They got packaged up there. Then the padlock was on. And then they're like, okay, wave goodbye to your cells because they were being sent to LA. So I'm like, okay, bye. See you in a few weeks. And then a few weeks later, they came back. And once they knew that they were on the aeroplane on their way back, I had 3 days of cell depleting chemo, which made me feel quite sick. And then...
And that's the purpose of that chemotherapy is to...
Yes. So it's to deplete all your cells. So they're basically at zero because when the cells get infused back into you, they multiply. So it's giving them room to multiply. And I went in on the Monday and this big, true like container of dry ice gets wheeled in and you think it's going to be amazing and massive and then this tiny little tube comes out and it gets infused back in through my PICC line and about 20 minutes later they said that's it. And then I was admitted.
It's hard to believe. I've had so many conversations where people go, it's going to be this big event and you got all this and it kind of almost looks like a bag of platelets being hung
up. It was tiny. I'm like, is that it?
Sitting here listening to you explain how we had the padlock put on the day, then went over to LA, then it's come back, you go, that's really an incredible coordination effort.
Yes.
And think how many people, like it does blow me away, move me to think how many people dedicate their lives to help keep others alive, you know, like the amount that for you to get that moment in that 20 minutes.
I was really lucky because I was patient number one. It was probably a year later. I actually got to meet the people that tracked my cells and organized the cells going over to America. I was able to speak at their office. And then later on, they're like, oh my God, it's so good to be able to actually see the person rather than just a number on a piece of paper. And that was amazing. And they were so grateful. And I said, no, you don't have to be grateful to me. I should be grateful to you because without you guys, I wouldn't be here today. And then just recently, I went to speak at their conference. That was amazing because without them, I wouldn't be here.
Mm.
And it was so nice to see them. And they said to me, it just makes what we do even more worthwhile knowing that, you know, now this is you and there's other patients like you as well. Then I got admitted back into hospital. And on day 11, they said I could go home.
Oh, wow.
I was quite lucky with my side effects though.
What side effects did you have?
Well, I didn't have neurotoxicity, which was great. So I had a very slight hand tremor. My heart rate did go up, but that was a combination of both being anxious and the side effect. And I just felt really nauseous and kind of run down. Not as bad as the chemo side effects. Yep. And then when I got home, I just remember feeling really weak for about a month later. But yeah, if I had my time, like if I had a choice, I would definitely do CAR-T over chemo. I know everybody's different, but for me, it was a lot easier than the chemo.
Yeah. And I mean, think that we do hear that is the bonus of CAR-T, that the side effects, they're either less toxic or the side effects aren't as, the swings of it aren't as high and low.
Yeah.
And it is somewhat more kinder to the body and the person, I would say.
Yes. And also it's using your own immune system to fight the cancer. So it's not necessarily attacking the good stuff. It's the bad stuff. So at 30 days, I had a PET scan and it was completely gone.
No. And you had never gone into a scan going, oh, it's somewhat reduced or we've had reduction?
No, never. So when the oncologist said, it's gone, I burst into tears. I could not believe it. It was the first time in almost a year that I actually had good news. It just felt like it was bad news after bad news. Leonard's jaw just dropped. He couldn't believe the picture. And then I had another scan at 90 days, and that was kind of the important one, because even if it doesn't work, you know, in the first month, it still can work. And that was still clear. And then I went to 6 months, 12 months, and then just recently 2 years.
And in all of that time, it's not come back or you've not had?
No.
Wow. That's incredible. To hear that and to hear that relief and go, okay, I had to go through everything to then get this great result. I mean, that's absolutely worth it. And, you know, as you say, you'd do it again if you could. You know, when people have a bone marrow transplant and they do have long-term side effects that can go for a number of months or if not years, unfortunately, have you experienced any side effects?
Just the fatigue. Like even now, I do get fatigued quite quickly. And I've noticed sort of in the past 6 months, just some cramps in my legs and feet and my fingers. I'm happy to live with the cramps if it means that, hopefully, touch wood, my cancer will never come back.
And you would have to ask, is that, you know, a result of, you know, many months of chemotherapy or is it a result of CAR-T? You may not know.
Yeah. So I think either way, I got off quite lucky in that respect. But there's the constant reminder that you've had radiation because there's the 4 little tattoos that they give you. But I've been lucky since I've achieved remission. I've made it my mission to kind of advocate for CAR-T and awareness around blood cancer. So I've been able to do I've been to Canberra twice, and it always falls on really weird anniversaries. Like the first time I was in Canberra was the day that I received my cells a year prior.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah. So thinking, God, if anybody had told me a year ago that in a year
in Canberra,
I would be in Canberra advocating for CAR-T, I would have thought, oh, be quiet, you're crazy. You know, you don't know what you're talking about. Really bizarre. But I feel almost very lucky to have had cancer. I've met so many beautiful people along the way, which sounds very strange to say, you know, that you're lucky. But yeah, I feel very lucky to have met these people. Terrible circumstance, but beautiful people. So
Yeah. And, you know, I do hear that a lot. People say that whether it changes your perspective, it changes the pace of life that you were living, it, you know, a number of things. And yes, for some people it does. It is a really awful experience as well. But I sometimes believe that it's about perspective as well. And it's an attitude that we have to choose. And it can be absolutely tiring and exhausting to go, okay, I'm going to constantly look on the bright side. I'm going to see the silver lining in this situation or anything like that. But I really do believe it's a daily choice. We don't have to make it every day, every hour, but it is a choice to have that outlook and perspective.
Yeah, like even the mundane things that every mother complains about, the making the school lunches. And I'm like, I remember when I was sick, I'm like, God, I just wish I could do that. I had no energy to even do that. And now I'm like, yes, I'll do it. I'll make it because I can. So it's the little things that you realize are the most important. Like I missed my kid's first day of school when I was on my first round of chemo. That was probably the worst day. And now I get to take them and pick them up, and it's just the little things. And you just realize that you're allowed to have your bad days. Mm. And you don't always think that everything's so rosy and perfect, but you realize that the little things, it's like they don't really matter. As long as you're healthy, that's all that matters.
Absolutely. I heard a saying recently and it said, when I can, I will. And I thought that's a really powerful statement. I think, as you were saying, like there was moments there that so many things were taken away from you and you almost weren't going to be here for your children, your husband, all the future days. And those moments of when you are lying in bed in hospital, you are really sick, and they're the days that you're wishing for. Those, as you said, those mundane tasks and whatnot. So when you're here and living, when you can, you will, and you should. So
yeah, you definitely and people used to say, oh, I'll save that for a good occasion or special occasion. Well,
yeah,
every day is a special occasion, yeah. You know, after you've had cancer, because unfortunately you don't know what tomorrow will be. You know, one minute I was perfectly fine and then the next day I was knocking on death's door. You don't know.
And I think that's the gift or the awareness that cancer does bring. We do walk around as humans with this thought sometimes in our heads that we're going to be 90, passing away in bed, having lived a fulfilled life. Yeah. But that's not always what is given. Time is borrowed. It's actually not promised to
exactly.
us.
You just have to enjoy every day.
How are your children and your husband during that, once they heard the news, and yourself? Oh. Was there a trust that needed to be built back within your body? And
it was really strange, I guess. I almost didn't believe it because mm-hmm. it was such a long time coming, and towards the end I was over it. I never thought it would actually happen. So then when I heard those words, you're in remission or there's no evidence of disease, I'm like, are you sure? Can I see the pictures? Like,
yeah.
And they're like, yes, it's real. But then afterwards, if I developed just a simple cold, because of where my tumor was, every time I get a cold, I will develop a cough. And so the first time I had a cough, it completely freaked me out to the point where they did give me an X-ray. And even then I'm like, but how do we know that's right? Because after the misdiagnosis of pneumonia, and I look back at that X-ray and I'm like, how did they miss that? Now looking back, you can actually see the massive tumor. I'm like, yeah. How was
and
that?
And you don't have a radiology degree.
No. And so now I'm like, are you sure? Are you sure? But I guess the biggest thing for me out of this and to anybody else is that if you believe that something's not right, then you have to keep pushing until you are happy with the answer, because you know your body better than anyone else. Mm. Doesn't matter if they've got a doctor's degree or something else. If you still feel that it's not right, you have to push, because absolutely. If I didn't push for that X-ray, I wouldn't be around.
Yeah. You do. You have to be your own advocate, and it can be really scary sitting in that position as a patient and up against a doctor who has a lot of training and has a lot of knowledge. But yeah, you're so right. You do. You have to advocate and you have to push. And we also need to remember that doctors, they're there to help us and not the other way around at some yes. points. And you can take control of your own health and within what you need.
So the day we found out, we went out for dinner and we celebrated, and yeah, it was almost surreal. I was sitting there, I'm like, I couldn't stop crying. Yeah, I'm like, oh, I actually don't believe it. I can't believe it. It was a very strange feeling. Even now I look back and I'm like, I still can't believe it.
And because are you coming up to 4 years this year? Is that?
So I've been in remission just over 2 years.
Yeah.
Diagnosed in late 2020, so coming up to 4 years.
I know you and I were talking beforehand and you had just been to Bali and you've been living life, and I bet you could – they were your hopes and your dreams, and now you got to live it. You got to go out. And
I know. Couldn't believe that we were actually away. The whole first week I was like, I can't believe we're here. I can't believe we're here. And by the end of it, they're like, well, get over it because we're here. And we left on the day that I was actually having my first chemo back in 2021. And then,
And was that planned?
No, it just happened to be that way. And then my mum said, oh, do you realize what date it is? I'm like, no. She said, oh, it's the day that you had your first chemo. I'm like, wow.
Wow. And how are your parents, you know, to witness everything that, you know, their child, their baby? I always say that it doesn't matter if you're 58 or whatever, your parents are still going to look at you with that, as that newborn that they brought home.
Yes. It was hard for everyone. It was hard to watch them with the constant bad news as well. I got to the point where I felt like I couldn't be honest. So there was a few times where I had to go in for a little procedure, or, and I almost didn't want to tell them because I didn't want to give them extra worry until it was over and it was, if I knew it was okay. Yeah, it was really hard to watch them. And of course, I'm the youngest, so I'm their little baby. I feel like I've aged them a lot. Yeah, it was very stressful.
And they, it sounds like, you know, having that beautiful support around you as well during that time was a saving grace as well.
Even though we were in lockdown.
I was about to say, made harder by the pandemic and the challenges of that.
But, you know, towards the end, my parents are like, well, bugger it, we're coming to see you. I don't care for this bubble. We can say we're carers, we're seeing you. But then, yeah, we just learnt to FaceTime in the hospital. You kind of make it work. As crappy as it is, then, you know, as soon as I'd come home on the Friday night, on the Saturday, they'd come around and we'd just sit there.
Yeah.
And we'd all be together. So it would make it better.
Because humans, it's hard to believe what we can adapt to and what we can get used to. And I always do say to people that are in that initial stage of diagnosis that unfortunately this will become a normal. Like, you will feel the rhythm, and it does take that little while. As you said, you learnt kind of your pattern of when you feel not so great to when you feel good and things like that. And you do. And I think it's adapting, you'll adapt to that, but then you'll also go, okay, I can find joy within that. And I know that that week's not going to be the day that I'm going to go out and see everyone or want to go and socialize or fill my bucket up. But then the second week, yeah, that may be when I go and get myself ready for the next.
The second week was actually quite good. And before I was diagnosed, I love cooking, but I like cooking like savory stuff as well. Yeah. But so I remember everyone would drop off food, which was beautiful, but you kind of just want your own food. So no matter how sick I felt, I'd still make dinner. Mm. And I remember coming home after CAR T and I felt so nauseous. And I remember everyone saying, don't worry about dinner, we'll just get takeaway, it's fine, just rest. I'm like, no, I'm cooking. And I remember being at the stove cooking and then running to the bathroom and vomiting, coming back. And this went on. I'm like, no, I'm going to do this meal, whether it kills me. And I did it. Yeah. Because you just want to get back to feeling as normal as possible.
And who you are at the essence. Yeah. It sounds like you're a baker, you feed your family, and that brings you joy.
Yeah. So I did it. I couldn't eat it, but I did it. You just, it's weird what you do. Even going to the supermarket and being able to go shopping for the meal or whatever, everyone's like, just get it delivered. Or my mum would say, I'll get it for you. And I'd be like, no, I want to do it.
It's your independence.
And, yeah. And a few times I did it without anyone knowing because they're like, don't you drive if you feel sick or don't go. I'm like, okay. And I still went and did it because I wanted to feel like me.
Yeah.
And now if my mum listens, she'll be like, I told you not to do
it. Sorry, mum.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, you just, you do what makes you feel good. And if it meant spending a day crying and that made you feel better, then I learned kind of halfway that if you need to do that, just do it and then tomorrow's a new day.
Sounded like there was a whole lot of surrendering for you.
Yeah, which is not in my personality at all.
Isn't it?
Wow. I hate it. Yeah. Like even when I was first diagnosed, a friend wanted to set up a meal roster and I'm like, no, it's just going to be added stress because our doorbell doesn't work and we have to leave an Esky and all this stuff. No, it's fine. So we didn't do that. But then everybody would just drop over stuff. So you have to learn to like lasagna, I've realized. Yes. Because everybody would bring lasagna.
So maybe your suggestion may be for people to look into other dishes that can be a bulk family meal.
Yeah, but no, I guess, God forbid, if I had my time again, I think to anyone that's got kids, I think it would be really useful if they just did the snacks and all that stuff that goes with school. that would be a massive help.
Yeah.
Rather than big trays of lasagna.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a website called Gather My Crew, and it's an incredible website where you can almost just set it up and it everyone can access it to you who you pass on. So you could list, you could go, how many lasagnas are being made or spaghetti bolognese. So people have a very clear overview of what's being done. And as you said, like that's such a helpful hint because lunchboxes are a nightmare when you're a well person and you're functioning a production line for children. So yes, absolutely, to be able to have a muffin or a muesli bar to be able to put in.
But also to be able to say, okay, took a lot for me. I like to do everything by myself. Even when I was really unwell, I hated saying, okay, you can help. It's just not in my nature. Mm-hmm. So learning to have to say, okay, or yes, please, that was really hard.
Mm. And do you think that having, like, it's almost like a muscle that you need to train and flex? Like, it may feel really uncomfortable to do it at first, to say, okay, yep, I actually need that help. But the more and more you do it and you let your guard down and you relax into it, the easier it becomes. And then you can feel the benefits of having people within your army to help you.
Definitely. But even like a lot of people offered to have our kids on the weekend just for, a few hours just so I could rest. And I'd ask them, do you want to go? And they're like, no, we want to stay home with you.
Yeah.
So we'd just, we'd put movies on and we'd lie on the couch together. I would always fall asleep, but at least I was just there with them and they didn't want to. So I wasn't going to push them.
Yeah, because they had lost something too. Like to have you home, they knew how precious that was and that is. And it just brings a sense of comfort having the parent energy in the house. So
they were just happy just to watch TV or play cards or as long as I was there with them.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter. Even our dog used to get annoyed with me. On the Monday morning when I'd leave, he'd look at the suitcase and kind of sulk. And then on the Friday night when I came home, he'd kind of not come near me. And then by the Saturday morning, he'd be back again.
You're forgiven.
Resting on my slippers and jumping up next to me. But yeah, he was kind of, he knew when I was upset. He'd just jump on the couch and literally hug me. It's amazing that they knew when you needed it.
Yeah. Pets are incredible. They have such a knowing as well.
Yeah.
With not even speaking,
And I remember one night I had such, it was when I was injecting to kind of build up my bone marrow again. And so I couldn't lie down. I couldn't stand up. I just had such bad bone pain. And I remember walking around the house. So he was there with me. And then finally, I found a comfortable position to lie in. So I was still for quite a while. And I remember he pushed my arm from the side of the bed as if to say, are you actually still alive? And I'm like, yes, it's okay. And then he just fell asleep.
He was watching over you.
Yeah, it's like he knew. It was incredible.
Mm. Wow, that's such a beautiful moment.
Yeah.
Well, I'm very aware of our time and you've given such an amazing capture of your story. And at every episode near the end, you've sown some beautiful seeds of wisdom throughout the episode. But we do ask if there would be any golden nuggets that you would share with the listeners. Do you have any words of wisdom other than what you've shared already?
I guess, like I've said already. So be your own advocate. If you feel something's still not right, make sure you get it checked. Like the nurse said to me, take those laxatives and allow yourself to feel sad, but then pick yourself up and just keep your eyes on the prize, basically.
Very, very true. To have that purpose and direction and to absolutely feel what you need to and then, as you said, keep moving forward.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. It has been an absolute pleasure to chat with you and I can't thank you enough for your time and your incredible voice for being an advocate for CAR-T. And I am so glad that it has the positive outcome that it has promised. And it is lovely to talk to you today and having known your living life.
Thank you.
That brings us to the end of today's episode. We hope that you have found it helpful in some way. We here at the Leukemia Foundation are a proud member of Talking Health Tech Podcast Network. If you would like more information on today's show or our services, please feel free to call 1-800-620-420 and someone will be able to connect you with your local blood cancer support coordinator. Also, if you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe, share, or even give us a rating on your podcast app. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Kate Arkadiff, and you've been listening to the Leukemia Foundation's podcast, Talking Blood Cancer.